This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to the New Books Network. This is a New Books in Military History. I am Boris Karpa, and with us we have here today is Gil Hahn, who wrote Campaign for the Confederate Coast, Blockade Running and Related Endeavors During the American Civil War. Happy to have you with us, Gil.
Boris, I'm delighted to be speaking with you.
And Gil is an independent historian. I believe that Gil also works in a railroad museum. Is that right?
I work part-time in the Hagley Museum, which preserves here in Wilmington, Delaware, what remains of the original DuPont Company gunpowder works.
But it also has some locomotives. Am I wrong? Am I right?
It has a stationary steam engine, which I demonstrate occasionally on weekends. I'm one of a number of demonstrators, but it's one of the pieces of industrial equipment that operates and is shown to visitors of the museum.
So really the first question, and you know, I ask this of all my guests on this show, how have you come to write about these Union blockade operations?
Well, I've always had an interest in history, in the Civil War, in military history in general, and in the history of technology as well. And I was looking for an opportunity to write on all of those subjects. And I looked first at the land war as part of the American Civil War, and decided that that had been fairly well covered a number of times, and then looked at naval operations, and in particular, the blockade, and decided there was more opportunity there to explore the subject and try to give a wider view to it than I've seen in other books I've read.
Which brings me to our next question. Can you tell us more about how you worked on this book, and what was the main difficulty, the main obstacle, if you will, you've encountered in writing this book? And of course, you overcame it. You've written the book, so can you also tell us about that? How you crossed the obstacle, if you will?
Well, I started by reading everything I could get my hands on. And my reading led me to other related topics but having gathered all the information, then the problem was how to organize it. I originally tried to make it a pure chronological account, and that just didn't work too well. So I went back and divided the topic thematically. Looking at the blockaders, looking at how the blockade runners were organized, looking at the various things that the Confederates tried to do in order to defend their coast and defend their port cities. Then I found I couldn't abandon entirely the chronological aspect. So in the last several chapters, I talked about all of those things put together, and drawing on the earlier thematic chapters, tried to weave a chronological narrative that that hit upon as many of the topics as possible, understanding that the reader already would have had a thorough understanding of the themes from the earlier chapters, and then put together something that wove together that showed how the success and failure of blockade running was tied first to tactical innovations, and later on and more effectively to the operations that the Federal Army and Navy undertook together to close down the major port cities.
Well, my next question is going to tie into this a bit, because I was reading your book, and maybe I misunderstood something, but I felt a bit of uncertainty in terms of what actually contributed more to the success of the blockade, whether it was the blockade operations themselves, or the fact that the Confederacy's forts were one by one falling to the Federal Army, you know, one by one being taken out of play, so to speak. So these two different factors, I'm not sure how to weigh their importance. Maybe I thought maybe you could shed some light on that.
I'd be happy to. The blockade was, in the first instance, a deterrent to the trade that otherwise would have come into the Confederacy under peacetime conditions. So it was important for the Federals to mount and maintain the blockade, because otherwise there would be absolutely no deterrent to the Confederates exporting their cotton and importing the weapons they needed to fight their war, and the other goods they needed to maintain their civil society. Ultimately, the ports were closed. The blockade was an ineffective weapon in the fact that it was not successful in wholly deterring or wholly preventing blockade running. But without it, as I guess I've just said, the commerce could have continued at a peacetime level. Ultimately, what shut down the blockade running was the capture of the ports. That was an important factor. To have not put in a blockade is sort of like walking around on the street with a note pinned to the back of your jacket saying, "Kick me." I cannot see the war being prosecuted successfully without that without the blockade having been put into place.
Which, once again, there's another question which follows, I think, logically from what you've just explained. It's, you know, my own research is a bit earlier in time. It's in the early Republic. And I've read a lot about the arguments which, during the Revolutionary War, during the quasi-war with France, in the War of 1812, we can see the American diplomats talking a lot about neutral rights and free goods and free ships and so forth. Yes, there's a lot of discussion of this, but now when the United States is a blockading party, of course there's some change. And maybe you can talk a bit about this change in America's approach to neutral rights when America is a blockading party. How much of a change really is there?
It's really a question of which foot the shoe is on. During the Revolution, or during the wars of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars, the United States was a neutral nation and was very much concerned with preserving neutral rights. In the American Civil War, the the Federals were a combatant, and they were intent upon preventing commerce from the outside world with the Confederates, who were also a combatant and recognized as such by the major neutral powers, Britain and France. They took a more in the American Civil War. The Federals took a much more aggressive point of position, as you might well understand, and they had they did receive some protests, and the British and British merchants in particular tried to assert certain rights, which or tried to assert certain privileges, I should say, which did not exist, and take positions which, as a combatant themselves, they would not have taken. So it's really a question of a point of view. Also, I would observe that in the 19th century, Britain, as the preeminent naval power, was in a position to pretty much lay down the law to the rest of the international world, and to my knowledge, received but probably did not act upon protests from other nations, neutrals to their fight with France. Conditions had turned by the time of World War I. Britain, as still the preeminent naval power in the world, tried to assert and impose a blockade on the Central Powers, and encountered considerable pushback from the non-combatant nations of Europe. And they found that they had to negotiate much of what they previously would have simply imposed. So it's a question that changes over time. It changes with respect to who is the combatant and who is asserting neutral rights, all as you might well expect. And it changes with the technology and with the circumstances given the then current conflict.
But during the Civil War, despite the fact that Britain certainly had the larger navy, it more or less accepted that the Federals were legally entitled to do more or less what they were doing. Certainly, they did not react. They were not as aggressive about it as they where in past conflicts, they've more or less accepted that the Federals could impose the blockade conditions which they claimed to.
Yes, and indeed that was a sticking point. The Federals wanted to acknowledged they were going to observe the niceties of international law, but in fact they tried to take the position that this rebellion was entirely an internal domestic matter of the United States, and that the federal government, being the lawful government of the entire United States, had the power to close the southern ports. In fact, very early on, Britain took the position that under international law, the rebellion had in fact created a de facto condition of independence and a de facto nationhood for the Confederates, and therefore they would regard both the Federals and the Confederates as combatants under international law, and therefore they took a role of being neutral and recognize the authority of the Federals to impose a blockade upon the other combatant. This, I think, was the better argument under international law. Also, it was in Britain's self-interest to do so. There had been a convention of the Treaty of Paris at the conclusion of the war with Russia in the 1850s that took the view that to be effective, naval blockades must be imposed with a power sufficient really to enforce them. The Confederates argued that the small federal navy couldn't possibly impose an effective blockade. But Britain took the view that even in its earlier stages, the Federals were imposing a blockade that was lawful under an international law, because at some point in the future, the British thought that they, as the major naval power, would be in a position to impose a blockade upon others. And so it suited them not to be too scrupulous about the amount of force that was needed to make the blockade be considered legal.
Okay, so this actually clarifies a lot of things to me. So clearly the British had some self-interest to accept the federal claims. Now, what I would like to move on to is really pull on your knowledge in another field, since as I've mentioned the steam engine, which you work with on purpose, because I'd like to ask a few questions about steam engines here. If we consider it's usually considered that the Civil War was the earliest, you know, the debut of steam on the battlefield, and so in your book you talk a bit about the differences in design between Confederate and Federal steam engines, and maybe you should clarify this a bit for our listeners.
Certainly. In the book, I point out that it was the preference of the Navy Department's own ship constructors to have steam engines that were most as reliable as possible. The reason for that is that these vessels, as turned out to be the case during the blockade in the American Civil War, were on station for weeks or months at a time, and they had it turned out they were recruiting people to be engineers aboard these vessels who were not necessarily the most skillful engineers around. So they needed engines that could be robust, that would could run reliably for long periods of time without an overhaul. On the other hand, the blockade runners, when they started employing purpose-built blockade running vessels, sought speed over absolute reliability. The pattern of their use explains that the blockaders, as I just said, were on station for weeks or months at a time, and they had to have their engines available at any point. A blockade runner is making a very quick trip from the Bahamas or from Bermuda or from Cuba to a southern port. They go one way. They then, when they arrive at their destination, they can let the fires in the boiler run down, do any necessary repairs, then make sure everything's properly lubricated, stoke up the boilers again, and they're off for another several days at sea. So it's a very different usage. They're, of course, have reliability as a key factor. It wouldn't be fortunate to have your engine kick out while you're running away from a blockading vessel. On the other hand, you can afford to have a vessel that is designed in a way to make use of the steam more efficiently than a simple robust engine might do, and therefore perhaps gain a knot or two of extra speed, which is very important for a blockade runner. There are different devices in steam engines that enable that. The steam engine that I demonstrated, Hagley, has what's called a slide valve, which you think of as a flexible hose that's feeding steam first into one end of the cylinder and then into the other end of the cylinder. There are more complicated devices to in the slide valve, the steam vent, the steam inlet vent and the steam exit vent open relatively slowly. So there's a long period of time when the steam is building up and then is cutting off. You can replace those with a valve that snaps open or snaps shut and increase the efficiency of your steam engine to a degree. That's the sort of devices that the blockade runners might have used that the Federal Navy would have avoided because there's more moving parts and things that are more apt to get out of kilter.
This reminds me a lot of what we hear about race cars, where they are not necessarily reliable, but there's a pit crew which can, you know, rapidly repair you and you're off again.
That's a perfect analogy. That's it down to a T. I'm going to steal that.
And the second thing which I would also like to ask, which also comes into engines, can you explain a bit how the procurement of the ships worked in the north and in the south? Maybe is this also affected design in some way?
Certainly. The Federal started off with a Navy intact. Their vessels weren't all necessarily suited to the blockade duty, but as the war started, they summoned them home. Some were in home waters and some were overseas. But the Secretary of the Navy undertook a program both of building vessels, not only for the coastal service, but also for the inland waters, but also of procuring vessels that they then adapted as best they could to military service. When you look at the Confederates and the blockade runners, you've really got two different constituencies acting in two different ways for two different purposes. The Confederates themselves acquired a few ships and armed them both for inland waters and for harbor protection. But they also undertook a program of building ironclads domestically and of building cruisers overseas. They contracted with British shipyards to build warships, which they then took out of Britain and armed. And these vessels preyed upon American vessels flying the federal flag. The best known of these was the Alabama, but there were a number of them. The Confederates also tried to build later in the war ironclads in overseas shipyards, but for the most part, these were detected by the British and French governments and prevented from entering Confederate service. The blockade runners were interested in commerce rather than warships. So they initially used freighter ships to send cargoes to the Confederate ports and to bring cargoes out. When the blockade started to be imposed in more force, these vessels were simply too large and slow to run the blockade. So the blockaders first purchased smaller, faster vessels that were capable of running the blockade, and eventually had purpose-built blockade runners built in British shipyards. These were low profile, smaller but highly powered ships that could dart in and out and try to evade the blockade, the blockading forces. So it's a different set of acquisitions, depending on the roles for which each of these constituencies wanted to use their vessels.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Thank you. That makes a lot of sense. This actually clarifies it quite a lot for me. Now, when you were describing the blockade operations, you touched a bit in your book on something which really interests me because it touches on some of my own research. You spoke about how the Union Navy constantly learned. They constantly had, for example, they had a system where they asked the squadron commanders to constantly send them feedback on how their tactics were working out, what was working, what was not working, and they were constantly adjusting based on these reports, based on what happened. And so there was really a system for institutional learning in place. And can you maybe explain more to us about how this worked? How the Union Navy learned?
Well, they learned and they didn't learn. Initially, they thought they were doing a good job in preventing any vessels from getting into and out of the ports, and that's just because they weren't seeing any of them. The blockade runners went in and out at night. The federal vessels were spaced so far apart that they didn't detect the blockade runners passing them. Also, in keeping with Navy regulations at the start of the war, the blockaders maintained a light aloft, and so they were actually acting as beacons, navigational beacons for the blockade runners, showing the blockade runners where the federal blockaders were and thus enabling them to run between them. Eventually, one of the consuls in the Bahamas, I guess it was, picked up on this and wrote to the Secretary of the Navy, Gideon Welles, to tell him that this was going on. So they extinguished the lights. And then in the South Atlantic blockading squadron, a new man was put in charge of the blockade squadron off of Charleston, and he rearranged the ships so that they were much closer together and that there were actually two and then three ranks of them. So they became more capable of detecting blockade runners. And once they started doing that, the vessels on station became more effective from the experience. And knew what to look for and what to be aware of. That the officer who was in charge there was and had made that innovation was later transferred to the West Gulf blockading station, where he passed on the knowledge that he had developed and the experience that he had developed at Charleston. So the blockading there became more effective. It was in a sense serendipitous that this particular fellow went to Charleston, had this good experience, and then was transferred in a way that enabled him to pass on the knowledge. It does not appear that the Navy necessarily had any device in place to pass on this information, to develop this information. Armies and navies develop that later on, and perhaps a very highly developed navy such as Britain's might have developed this at this time. But in my research, I didn't come across any deliberate device or pattern or technique to try to pass information around this around. It was simply what someone heard or an idea someone had, and then it got passed on fortuitously. One of the things that occurred to me in writing the book was that the Federals and the Confederates both had available to them at that time searchlights called calcium lights or lime lights or Drummond lights. And they use these in various ways. It struck me that a very junior officer came up with the idea of putting one of these searchlights in his vessel and using it to scan the horizon. He made a suggestion like this to the Secretary of the Navy, but his letter didn't get answered. I guess because the officer was so junior. Late in the war, one of the squadron commanders came up with the same idea passed it on to the Secretary of the Navy, who responded positively. At that point, the war was almost over and nothing really came of it. Again, it was an idea that hit someone that was passed upon, but which just was not picked up and developed upon. So it's a spotty lesson of learning in the Union Navy. And I think under the circumstance, simply good fortune.
Okay, that's actually clear. That's clear. Maybe I've not understood things as well as I should have, but now I do understand, and I thank you for clarifying this up, for clearing this up for me, and hopefully our readers. And to follow on from this, what about the Confederates? They had lots of ideas. They seemed to have lots of gadgets which they were experimenting with to try and solve their problems, but they didn't seem to succeed very much. Is it because of some problems with their planning, or is it just that they didn't have the resources?
They had some good ideas. They had some interesting ideas, but they pursued them in a way that I think was self-defeating. They did not have a highly developed industry the way that the northern states did. They did have some industry, but not a lot. What industry they did have was taxed pretty much to the limit by sustaining the war effort on land. They came up with the idea for naval protection of building gunboats, which was actually an old American idea that never really worked out. But what they planned to do was to build, instead of building a big frigate, they would build a lot of small steam-powered vessels armed with a rifled cannon individually they would be sort of a swarm that could attack federal vessels with some impunity, having the federal vessels being armed primarily with smoothbore cannon that did not have the range or striking power of the rifled cannon. The trouble was that the Confederates didn't have the capacity to build that number of steam engines, to build that number of rifles, or to build that number of hulls. And so the project fell apart. They came up with the idea of using torpedo boats, which were, again, steam-powered vessels that used stealth rather than standoff power to deliver what were called at the time torpedoes. These were essentially just exploding devices. They, at the end of a spar, to run up against a federal vessel and sink it by exploding this device against its wooden hull. They built one or two of these from their own resources, and only late in the war came up with the idea of having them built in Britain and then shipped to the Confederacy. which would have been a much more effective use of their resources and use of British technology in the place of domestic Confederate technology. But they came up with it too late. They were effective in developing the torpedo as a device that we would described today as an underwater mine. These were at first of limited effectiveness, but proved efficient in causing the British, the federal blockaders to be more cautious. They did take a significant toll of federal vessels and could have become an effective weapon. They were effective only when fairly freshly put in the water, because any leak would neutralize the explosive charge inside. Thus, when Admiral Farragut steamed into Mobile Bay, he inadvertently steamed across an old minefield. The reports I've read say that the sailors could hear the triggers snapping, but only one vessel, one of the monitors, was sunk as a result of a mine. So it was he was a very aggressive admiral, and was undeterred by the torpedoes. He is quoted as saying, "Damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead." It appears he didn't say that, and the phrase came into use at a later time. But it makes good theater.
It strikes me that a lot of this stuff is not really new ideas, because I've come across a lot of this. Certainly, the spar torpedoes were, offered to the U.S. Navy by Fulton, even when Jefferson was still president. And some kind of primitive naval mines were also experimented with at the time. This is a whole set of ideas of, we don't really have a navy, what do we do? And all of these are the same ideas.
That's exactly right. And what you have with the American Civil War, certainly in the naval part of it, is what does a weak power do to deter a strong naval power? In the Revolution, it was the United States trying to break away from Britain. In the American Civil War, it was the Southern states trying to break away from a relatively strong federal navy that grew much stronger as the war went on. So yes, these are weapons of a weaker power. The same thing is true of what's referred to as the guerre de course, the using naval cruisers to prey upon an enemy's commercial vessels. The United States did that in the War of 1812 and during the Revolution by issuing letters of marque. The Federals, the Confederates, did the same thing. They actually got a couple of letters of marque, cruisers, privateers is the proper term, operating under letters of marque, but they quickly became went out of action because there was no profit in them from attacking federal vessels, and certainly they were overmatched by federal armed vessels. And to be to capture a prize lawfully, a privateer has to bring the prize into a home port where the capture can be adjudicated by a prize court. It was very difficult for the privateers to bring their their captured prizes into Confederate ports as the federal blockade grew, and the British and French made plain that they would not permit the Confederates to set up prize courts in their jurisdictions. Benjamin Franklin, as American minister to France, operated as a prize court in France while the French looked the other way during the American Revolution, and which was a big help to the privateers at that time. The custom of the international community had changed sufficiently by the time of the American Civil War that that would not was not to be tolerated.
I hope you don't mind. I'd like to ask your opinion about another expert whose judgment may be a bit conflict with yours. There is a book which I have been reading recently, which is Richard Pape's Bombing to Win, which, for those who haven't read it, while it's called Bombing to Win, it's also about naval operations, and Richard Pape argues that trying to do a coercive approach, what he calls coercive approach, trying to defeat an enemy indirectly by cutting off their commerce, by blocking their ports with your navy, is somewhat overrated by experts and by naval planners, and he thinks that it's nowhere as useful as directly engaging with the enemy with your land forces or with your naval forces. And do you think that this applies to our lessons from the Union blockade operations and the Civil War?
I think it depends largely upon the circumstances. We haven't had an all-out total war since World War II. And the wars that we've been having have been, in that time, more limited wars, wars in which have limited objectives and also may employ limited means. Looking at the American Civil War, that was an all-out war. The Federals were intent upon conquering the Confederates, and the Confederates were intent upon not being conquered. And in that context, the blockade was, I don't see as having a coercive effect. It's simply another act of war. And in that instance, the alternative would have been fight on land and blockade by sea, or fight on land and not blockade by sea, in which case fight on land is a more dubious proposition because the Confederates are in the position to make fuller use of their economic resources and convert their resources into arms and other goods to support both their war effort and their civil society. I'm reminded that early in the Civil War, General of the Federal Armies Winfield Scott had proposed what was at the time lampooned as the Anaconda Plan, in which he recommended a strong naval blockade and no invasion, asserting that after having been deprived of their pleasurable goods, the Confederates would come meekly back into the Union. That strikes me as a very doubtful proposition. And I would agree with Pape. In that circumstance, the blockade would have very little coercive effect, if for no other reason than the technologies existing at the time gave the advantage to the blockade runners over the blockading vessels. On the other hand, in World War I, you see the British Navy imposing a blockade on Germany and the Germans imposing a blockade on Britain through submarine warfare. The British blockade was of surface vessels, and they had, as I think I mentioned, had to negotiate the effectiveness of their blockade with the neutral powers. In World War I, the German submarines came within a few weeks, perhaps, of starving Great Britain out of the war. So it depends upon the circumstance and depends upon the type of conflict you have going on. I was, I will say, very taken by Pape's example of the Vietnam War, where the actions taken by President Johnson were seen as not very effective because the North was doing a little more than, or was encouraging what seemed to be an insurgency. In the 1970s, under President Nixon, the coercion was much more effective because the North was trying to mount what was, in essence, a formal, organized, standard military operation. So yes, I think there are limitations to Pape's arguments, but I think there is some validity in it as well.
Okay, so I think that we should draw towards a conclusion here. Mm-hmm. And the last question I ask, it's also one which is a custom here with our show. You know, we, all of us who are writers are also readers. And so I'd like to ask you about your own reading. What are you reading now? What you could maybe recommend to our audience?
I've been reading a lot recently about World War I. And so at the moment, my historical reading consists of Lossberg's War, which is a new recent English translation of Fritz von Lossberg's memoirs of World War I. He was an officer on the general staff who was sent as a fireman, essentially, to help prop up the German armies, various German armies on the Western Front when they were in danger of being overmatched by Allied offenses. I'm also consistent with that reading Jack Sheldon's The German Army on the Western Front, 1915. For my off-hours reading, I've just finished reading Ian Banks' A Player of Games, wonderful science fiction, and I've just started reading Upton Sinclair's Wide as the Gate, which I believe is the fourth novel in his Lanny Budd series. Also, in my car, I've been listening to Robert Galbraith's Lethal White, which is, of course, the series that took up where Harry Potter left off.
Okay, I thank you for being with us today.
Of course, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for speaking with me.